I'm Author Function.
I'm Galvin.
And this is the Secret Boss Podcast, where we talk about the best auteurs in gaming, whether they deserve that title or not. And today we are talking about Shigeru Miyamoto, a person that none of you have ever heard of before.
Fin dog.
Your dog's heard of it.
Yeah, my dog has heard of it.
Fucking hipster. Who the hell is Shigeru Miyamoto? Could you explain for us, Offer?
We're going to keep this. We're going to keep in my dog in the background. Okay, sure. Yeah, so Shigeru Miyamoto, if you know any game developer, you probably know who Shigeru Miyamoto is. Although I think Kojima has like upended him as like the video game person. But whatever. For a very long time, it was Shigeru Miyamoto. He's the Mario guy. He made Donkey Kong. He made Super Mario Brothers. He was very heavily involved in the Legend of Zelda series. But we can talk about that later. Miyamoto is a very famous figure in video games and very influential. And he is very heavily associated with Nintendo in general and their trajectory as a whole. But it seems like there isn't really a strict idea about who Miyamoto is. It's not very specific. It's just kind of the idea of what Nintendo is, and he's just kind of the face of Nintendo a lot of the time. So I thought it was going to be a really good idea to talk about Miyamoto specifically as a director, to sort of like get down deep into his actual design ethos and what he is actually doing on the individual game level instead of as a like corporate executive. But me and Galvin, we've had a little bit differing ideas on how to do this, because I was interested in Miyamoto as a director, but Galvin can talk more about what he was doing.
Yeah, it was very strange to me because we're still figuring out the idea of what is an auteur when it comes to gaming. Like for film, it's very easy, right? You pick director. That's the one you pick. Sometimes you pick a writer if they're very, very prominent in writing, like Aaron Sorkin or Paddy Chayefsky. But for gaming, it's a little bit different because there's so many different titles. There's director, there's designer, there's lead designer, level designer, art director. I mean, like you can come up with a bunch of different definitions for what they're doing. And with Miyamoto, it's definitely strange because what Offer basically did was he picked director, but I went, okay, director and designer, because that was also how I was picking other auteurs for Secret Boss. And I feel like, yeah, this kind of puts things to the test because we did a lot of research on Miyamoto like leading up to this episode, and I kept flipping through articles that was like, here are examples of what things Miyamoto has done. Yoshi's Island, Mario Kart 64, and these are games that he has not been director or designer on, but producer on. So that's a whole other level of muddling, basically. But yeah, I guess this will kind of hopefully decide what an auteur is for future episodes. I don't know. Do you think it helped clear up the definition of auteur for you anymore, Offer?
I'm not sure if it would clear up the definition, but I think that it made me more thoughtfully engage with the idea of what position in game development should be more heavily associated with the auteur. Spoiler alert for the episode, I think I'm going to stand by what I did. I think that the director is going to be a very useful tool and a figure to be assigning the role of the author to. That's going to be my thesis for this podcast, which don't usually have theses. But yeah, that's where I'm coming from. Yeah, I've seen a lot of differing opinion. Miyamoto, like basically everything he touches, he gets assigned the role as one of the creators of it. Paper Mario Sticker Star is a game that he doesn't really have any specific role in, but people pretty heavily associate the direction that game went in because of Miyamoto, because he was consulting on it for like at like an
E3,
I think. He just said like, oh yeah, I think that you should more heavily focus on Mario characters. And now the entire Paper Mario fandom is like, Miyamoto ruined Paper Mario. So like, it's really amazing how much of a big figure he is and how people will like assign where a game goes based on his involvement.
Also just like how people are like, Shigeru Miyamoto, he made Mario 1, 2, 3, World, and then you read it, Super Mario World interview, and he was just like, oh yeah, I just popped in every once in a while they were doing, and we're like, yeah, you can't do that. And I'm like, that's a classic producer role right there, just popping in every once in a while and saying, nope, you can't do that, and then walking out like you own the place.
And talking more about this role of who is the auteur in game design, I am going to talk a little bit about film, because we both really enjoy film and film history, and it's also oh, okay. Well,
I was hate watching it the whole time. I don't know what you were thinking. Did you not see me with my arms crossed the entire time, every time you were watching the hundreds of movies you probably watched together? No.
Right. When we watched Jean Dielman together, you were sitting there stone-faced thinking about how much you hated film as a medium.
Yeah.
All 4 hours.
I gave it 9 out of 10, you know, like a negative score. It's not a 10 out of 10, so.
Oh my God, can you imagine? Anyway, so film is often considered to be like the first medium in the like new media classification, which are generally like electronic media that is created during the modern period. Kind of like stands as an example, a case study for how other mediums are going to proceed. A lot of like media scholars will look to film to think about like how future mediums are going to develop as a culture, not specifically technology wise, but how people are going to discuss them. Because games are still relatively new as a medium, and there is debate over who is going to be the author or auteur, if any, over the game medium. And if we look to film, you can see a very long and storied history with its auteur theory, or lack thereof. Because at the very beginning of the medium, movies were more associated with theater. And in theater, the writer is considered the author of that theatrical work. If you see a Shakespeare play, oftentimes it will be a Shakespeare play because Shakespeare wrote the play, even if he's been dead for 400 years and he can't direct the thing. He's not acting in it. He's not doing anything else. He's just the writer, but it's still a Shakespeare play. So when you adapt Shakespeare into a movie during the early period, it would be like, okay, this is like a Shakespeare movie, not specifically like outlined as crediting him as creating it, but in the cultural conversation, it would be a movie by Shakespeare. And then later on, during the studio system in like Hollywood and stuff, the producer would become the author of the work because they were in charge of everything on an industrial level. From a industrial perspective, the producer is like at the very top, making decisions about who's going where, who's doing casting, who's doing directing, who's doing all the writing, and making all those little choices. But eventually, as the film medium would develop and critics were closely looking at it, they would get more interested in the editing and the composition of film. Like, what is this shot trying to portray? And that's when we sort of get the idea of the director as the auteur of a work. And that's basically how it is today, where the director is often seen as the auteur. But sometimes you get exceptions. I'm thinking of like Martin Scorsese and Thelma Schoonmaker. Yeah, Schoonmaker. That's what I said. Yeah. So Scorsese is the director and he's often seen as the auteur. But people will often argue that Thelma's work is so important to his movies that she is practically like one of the defining voices as an editor, or Paul Schrader as a screenwriter for Scorsese's work. So you have all these different personalities come together and you can each view them through the lens of a different person. But overall, a director is often seen as the auteur. Now, that doesn't necessarily apply to games. Like I was saying, if you just borrow the same conventions from another medium, that doesn't really work as well. So this is very much something that is in debate, and it is still in debate for theater and movies, but even more so in video games, where that figure hasn't really come out perfectly yet, because Miyamoto has been a director, he's been a producer, he's been a consultant, he's done all kinds of different work. If we're doing it through a different lens, I think that can be very insightful for thinking about games in general with a famous figure who's done a whole lot of different things. And I think that it's going to be really useful for us to think about Miyamoto in this lens.
That kind of confusion between like director and writer really somehow crosses over specifically the Miyamoto story, because what I researched when it comes to Miyamoto actually did come to that, I think, a little bit. Miyamoto, he didn't start out as a director of Nintendo. He wasn't like a big hit honcho. The story was, you know, he was hired as an employee while Nintendo was still doing a bunch of different stuff like toys and all sorts of things. Miyamoto had an industrial design background, so he submitted supposedly a bunch of ideas for cute coat hangers, and then he got hired through that. And then it turns out that he got into the company and he realized that the company had already filed patents for the coat hangers he presented before he had even gotten to the company, immediately after they hired him. The point is, Miyamoto, when he first started getting into Donkey Kong, that was the first game he had like really big control over, although he was doing graphic design before. He pitched himself as a game designer in the sense of it being different from technological design, basically. Everybody else who was making video games then, at least in Nintendo, were mainly programmers. Miyamoto could write sketches based on graphic design, things he drew up because he had an artistic background. He basically defined himself in this way for the first couple years, I want to say. He described himself as a kind of narrative designer of games, which is really interesting because the narrative of Donkey Kong was you're a guy and your dumb pet ape has stolen your girlfriend, and you have to go up and beat the ape. Not exactly like a novel's worth of content there. But I think it's interesting because, at least according to how Miyamoto described it, in the initial wave of game design, when people were still figuring out what game design even meant, people were hiring apparently novelists to design video games for them, to write scenarios for what these games would be. And these would be like really thick stacks of narratives for these weird little bleeps and bloops. And I think that's interesting because that's basically not where we go from now. I think a lot of game design now is, what if a Metroidvania was fucked up? Or what if you could do skates, but you were a bus? I don't know.
What if there was a dating sim, but it was ironic?
What if you could do that? Someone get this guy $1 million over here.
Hell yeah. Another thing I think is really interesting about like Miyamoto is that in early days, people were talking about him as a cinematic game designer, which is like crazy to think about 40 years afterward, because Nintendo is very much not associated with cinematic video games. Nintendo isn't associated with narratives like cinema is, not associated with really strong visuals, or not like realistic visuals at least. So the idea of Miyamoto as a cinematic game designer just didn't make any sense to me. But then I read, a book by Jennifer DeWinter about Shigeru Miyamoto that really like made me understand the perspective a lot more, because she argues that Miyamoto really presented Donkey Kong as a spatialized narrative. It was a narrative that is presented within the game, and this narrative is portrayed through the physical space. And that as you progress through the game, as you go up, you can see cutscenes where Donkey Kong is moving, and your hero's journey would be like going through this area where the position of power is at the top and the position of less power is on the bottom, and you're very gradually going through that. Donkey Kong is not the first game to have cutscenes, and it's not the very first game to have like tension through its space. But I think what makes it interesting is that it really combines that along with music and just having like a whole complete narrative throughout the whole thing. And it's like, okay, now I understand where people were coming from with Miyamoto as a cinematic director, because he was also like really interested in graphic novels or manga as he was growing up, and he was really interested in doing that, but that didn't really work out for him because he wasn't a good drawer, I think, was his reasoning. Do you remember this, Galvin?
Well, he had cycled through multiple jobs he wanted to grow up with. Apparently, he had watched something on NHK about this puppeteer who did really cool stuff. So he was initially like, I want to be a puppeteer. Then he wanted to be a manga artist. And I think he did drop out because he wasn't good enough at drawing. But then he wanted to be like a news anchor. So it was like a bunch of things, all based on like presenting things to people. So I think he had that showman's aura to him. But
right. I realize now that we didn't describe what Donkey Kong is, but I think that Miyamoto, luckily, is so famous that we don't really have to describe.
Hopefully. I mean,
Okay, fine. We can describe it if you really want to.
I mean, I think people still think of Miyamoto in some ways as the Super Mario Bros. Guy. Some people, I think, still think his career began there, and they don't really think of the Donkey Kong arcade cabinet.
All right. So, Donkey Kong, you have Jumpman, a.k.a. Mr. Video, a.k.a. Mario, his pet gorilla. He goes up and captures a woman named Pauline, goes up this constructed building, and Mario's like, oh, okay, I gotta save him through jumping and with hammers, while Donkey Kong is throwing barrels at him. And you go through the levels, there's 4 levels, they're each different in their own way, and yeah, Mario defeats Donkey Kong at the end and saves the day. Yeah, so that's Donkey Kong. Do you have any further thoughts on Donkey Kong? Because I don't. It's really hard to talk about arcade games, you guys.
I think it's really good. I was very surprised at how much I enjoyed it. And I just want to say I'm very, very glad you brought up the space thing, because that is like my entire thesis for this episode. That's all I prepared, basically. The more I played Miyamoto's games, I was like, yes, he loves space. This is like everything to him. It's like what builds the world, it's what builds the goals of the world, but we can get to that later. Do you have anything to say about the sequels to Donkey Kong? I wanted to mention Donkey Kong Jr. in 3, because it's so interesting that they like basically threw out the mechanics of the first one. I've never seen any arcade game do that, where it's like, okay, sequel time, let's just get rid of everything you did before. I bet there were riots when Donkey Kong 3 first came out, because it's like, what even is that game compared to the first two? It's not even a platform.
Yeah, the whole arcade trilogy is very strange. Donkey Kong Jr. is completely different. You play as Donkey Kong Jr., who was not in the first game, and the villain is Mario, who has captured Donkey Kong, and you need to save Donkey Kong. So you play as Donkey Kong Jr., this little monkey guy, and instead of jumping, or there is jumping in the game, but you don't have hammers, you're instead spending most of the game climbing up vines.
There at least is some connection to the first game with, like, the same springs and the same fire, if I remember correctly, and there's also, like, yeah, there is jumping and fall damage and things like that.
It was so weird to me that there was fall damage. I died to fall damage once in Donkey Kong. I was like, okay, I'll not do that again. But when I died to fall damage, like, multiple times in Donkey Kong Jr. is like, why is this in the game? Why do I have to keep track of this?
Yeah, and the fact that The fact that he ends up putting fall damage in Super Mario 64 years later, maybe we can claim fall damage is a Miyamoto trademark of his platformers. It'd be great if he came out with a new platformer in 2025 and there was still fall damage.
Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about Donkey Kong Jr. from a close reading perspective.
Okay.
I will say that a lot of the mechanics in Donkey Kong Jr. end up being in Donkey Kong 94, which is Donkey Kong remade for the Game Boy, except with 100 new levels. And it's incredible. I love Donkey Kong 94. Best Game Boy game. Miyamoto did not direct it, so we won't be talking about it, but he did design on it. So that's all I'm allowed to say in Donkey Kong 94.
I do think this contributes to the part you said earlier, referring to that book, although I did not read the book, so I'm just completely pulling this out of my butt right now. I think the final stages of Donkey Kong 1 and 2 do contribute to the idea of this kind of narrative thing through space. The final stage in Donkey Kong 1 is built around removing these, I guess, screws in these girders that will drop Donkey Kong from top to the ground. And Donkey Kong Jr. is about raising these locks through vines from the bottom to the top, like getting all the locks up. So it basically goes from a game about trying to get from the bottom to the top, just like as a goal by itself, to basically this system by which the girders operate on that you're trying to dismantle. You dismantle the system by getting all these parts and removing them so that the person at the top can collapse to the bottom. You want to do a socialist reading of that, or do we want to move on?
I'm not going to do a socialist reading of fucking Donkey Kong, but yeah, okay. That does make sense. I think Donkey Kong 3 completely throws that out the window as well. You play as Stanley the Bug Man instead of Mario, who is just this random guy who's never in like any other Mario game, who is an exterminator who shoots this bug spray at Donkey Kong, where he's like shaking a bunch of hives to get bugs to attack you. And if you spray him with enough bug spray, then he falls down and you go to the next level. Now, this one is a pretty big departure. You're still technically platforming, you're jumping around, but it's mostly like a shooting game, but with like gravity, I guess. People seem to really hate this game, but I think it's pretty fine. Honestly, I'd probably want to play it more often, but yeah, I understand why people don't like it as much because it feels a lot more repetitive.
And it's not as fun to me. I feel like there is something inherently more fun in traversing from the bottom to the top. It feels like you're making progress. With Donkey Kong 3, it's like the progress is basically Donkey Kong just inches up a little bit once he shoots the bug spray up his butt, but every once in a while he inches back down, and it's just like so annoying compared to 1 and 2. Yeah, I really did not like Donkey Kong 3. Do you have a socialist reading to say about Stanley the Bugman shooting sprays up his ass? Anything about that?
No, I do not. I don't even have a joke to riff on here. I don't know where I would go with that. Okay. After that, the Famicom comes out, and Miyamoto starts working on that instead of the arcade cabinets. Let's see, what does he do first?
He does baseball.
Yeah, he designs baseball, but he doesn't direct it, so I don't talk about it, and I did not play baseball, so this is all you.
Based on what I'm seeing from the Wikipedia page, which is a reliable source, it seems like the only games Miyamoto designed but did not direct are baseball, tennis, and golf, if I remember correctly. And also Steel Diver, which he did a side mode on for the 3DS. Remember that Steel Diver, the 3DS submarine game? But yeah, those are the games he did design on and not direction on. And Wii Fit, but I did not play Wii Fit for this episode, unfortunately.
The way that Wikipedia is crediting those feels really strange to me, because Miyamoto has been doing design work on a lot of different games throughout his history. So I'm not really sure how they're figuring out that credit on Wikipedia. I also looked on Moby Games, which is like a completely different crediting system. And the book I read has a really wild crediting system where basically every game he's touched, he's being credited on. Like even Metroid Prime, which was developed in America, she credits Miyamoto as being one of the designers on, which I mean, I haven't really researched it, so I don't really know. But from my understanding, he really didn't do much on that game.
Yeah, Walt Disney did every Walt Disney movie because his signature appears in the opening credits.
Very true.
He had a touch on every single one.
I love Disney's Coco. Wonderful.
After playing those games, baseball, tennis, and golf, I have to say, if we're basing our data solely on that, then yeah, absolutely, the director is the author of the game, not the designer. What the fuck are these games? These are not related to anything at all that Miyamoto has done. It doesn't relate to my thesis, doesn't relate to anything. They're super unfun to play. They're just dog shit. I have less than nothing to say about these games, honestly. And no, I mean, I could say that baseball, tennis, and golf are interesting in that they helped argue that they helped transition Miyamoto from the expectations of arcade games to NES. Because I think you can kind of map that trajectory over time from the arcade cabinets which he modified for the NES over to the original NES games. He first did baseball, tennis, and golf, but the first original NES game I think he worked on was Devil World, which is still very much an arcade game, but it wasn't an arcade cabinet. It was just like an NES game, but it's very much designed like an arcade game. So I think tennis, baseball, and golf, he kind of made as games that were like things that you couldn't make into arcade games. He talks about this. He talks about how Nintendo at some point wanted to do a baseball arcade cabinet, but they couldn't because there are 9 innings in baseball. So you have to play for the entire game. And yes, in baseball, you do play through all 9 innings. Is it interesting? No. Bad games. Do not play them.
Okay. What? Tell me what your favorite one is out of the 3, and I'm going to bet it's golf. Is it golf? Damn.
It was tennis.
I haven't played any of them, but I was guessing it was going to be golf. Terrible. Very sad. Called my shot.
Baseball is kind of interesting in that when you're playing outfield and you catch the ball, you can use the directional pad to choose where you throw the ball to. So up is like second base, right is like first base, left is like third base. It basically represents the diamond. So it's kind of like not turn-based strategy, but like real-time strategy mechanics. But also, simultaneously, when the ball goes into the outfield, you can't control the outfielders as they run to it. So you have to watch them move very, very slowly to the ball as all the infielders are like making it to third base. I can't emphasize to you how slowly to move. It's the most frustrating thing of all time. I hated baseball. It's interesting, but it's like really, it made me feel like blood hot rage.
Well, before we get into Devil World, he also worked on some light gun games for the NES. Wild Gunman, Duck Hunt, and Hogan's Alley. I'm going to group them all together because I feel like they're mostly focused on the joy of shooting a physical gun as your controller, where you would point this little plastic gun at the TV and it would recognize where you're shooting based on some really interesting tech that you can look up online. I'm not going to go into it. And I think that you can see some of that physicality of Miyamoto's design work later on with like the Wii and its influence. The joy in these games is the physical parts of it. If you emulate Duck Hunt, where you're just shooting a bunch of little ducks on your screen by moving your mouse around and hitting them, it's not going to be the same because a lot of the joy in it is like actually moving around and having the simple joy of experiencing the idea of shooting a gun.
Yeah, I mean, I could kind of argue it, but like I can kind of argue some things I do see in it, in that like moving your gun around the space and aiming at specific things is part of his spatial kind of obsession that I'm going to keep arguing. And also that the physicality of things leads to the motion controls that come later with the Wii and things like that. Or how he has some discussion when he was like being interviewed about like Super Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, which he didn't design or develop, but he produced for. He talks a lot about how he wants the player to feel like the main character. So putting the player in the shoes of the anonymous shooter kind of does that. But then again, I didn't play any of the games, so I feel like I'm kind of talking out of my ass here.
Yep. I also did not play them. I think I played Duck Hunt somewhere. I must have emulated it, and it didn't really hit me. Anyway, to quickly describe the other ones, Hogan's Alley is basically like a shooting gallery kind of thing, where you're shooting fake cutouts of criminals and trying to avoid the cops, because shooting cops is bad, apparently. And in Wild Gunman, it's basically like a quick draw in the Wild West, where you have to draw your gun as quickly as possible and shoot the other guy. And it doesn't actually measure your aim in that game. You just have to shoot as quickly as possible. So you'd shoot away from the TV and press the button and it would be good, which is really
funny. That's actually so lame. Yeah, that's crazy. They sold that for money. That's insane.
Yeah. Oh, and that one was an adaptation of a arcade game that Gunpei Yokoi did. So that was a port. And Miyamoto directed a few other ports on the Famicom, but we'll get to that later. Next up is Devil World.
I like this one. Yeah, this one's interesting because it's basically obviously a Pac-Man ripoff, but with Christ. See, Pac-Man is a devil creature. He doesn't know what he's doing there. You, on the other hand, are a soldier of Christ. This basically, is it a ripoff of Bubble Bobble? Because the main character kind of looks like Bub or Bob, whatever, from that game. I don't know when Bubble Bobble came out. But basically, you're a dragon, which is not a devilish creature. And you walk around collecting crosses, you know, symbols of God, and blasting devils as you eat all the pellets, which are very godlike, you know, the pellets from the Bible. You remember that? And it's like, I think it's interesting because it's like obviously Pac-Man, but the screen also moves. That's the gimmick here, basically. This devil at the top that like moves his hands up and down, left and right. You've played Smash Brothers. You've seen the guy before. And the screen moves with it, basically. And that's interesting to me because it's like shifting space as they're moving around. I don't know what it's supposed to mean narratively, other than you're fighting the devil, I guess. But it does make for like an interesting changing of playing field that makes it a little bit better than Pac-Man. And that, by definition, is just better than Pac-Man. Yeah, I like this more than Pac-Man.
Yeah, I really like Devil World. I don't like any Pac-Man games or any of their clones specifically. Like, I'll play Pac-Man and I'll be like, oh yeah, this is cute, this is fun. And then I'll walk away and go to a different place, the barcade. And part of my enjoyment was probably that I was a little bit drunk. Yeah, I'm not a big Pac-Man fan. But the idea of having Pac-Man where it's like scrolling around and the screen is moving everywhere is like, okay, I have to completely replan everything I'm doing at every second because I might have to go into a completely different area. And whereas with Pac-Man, I'm not going to say Pac-Man is easy, but I feel like there's not a lot of interesting choices when I play Pac-Man, or at least I'm not invested enough in the mechanics where I'm thinking deeply about it. Whereas with Devil World, when the screen is scrolling and there's a chance I'm going to get crushed against the wall, like there's a new enemy and it's the environment instead of just the enemies moving around. And I love it. It's so much fun. Way better than Pac-Man.
I think this brings up the first thing I want to get into when it comes to like my claim of his space. And now Miyamoto's interested in it. He really wants you to optimize your way through his space. Everyone's heard the story about how when he was designing The Legend of Zelda, he was thinking back to his childhood memories of like exploring a cave and things like that. I was thinking about this a lot, not just for Legend of Zelda, but a lot of his games. Because like when you go through the same cave again and again, or go through a place that only you know about, but you're so familiar with it, you kind of begin to optimize your path through it, or like to it, and things like that. With at least Donkey Kong 1 and 2, I think it's interesting that the game ends so early. Like after 3 to 4 levels, basically, there's like such an ending point when you drop the girder and you kill Donkey Kong or you kill Mario and Donkey Kong Jr. And it's like, you technically did it, you beat the game. But of course, these are arcade games that don't print tickets. So it's based on getting a high score. So you basically start at the beginning all over again. And it's basically, it's giving you these 4 levels or 3 levels or whatever. And your goal is to basically like find the best way through them. You can get points by jumping over barrels and things like that. But most of the points you'll be getting are usually from the bonuses, which count down based on the timer in the corner. So you're basically like encouraged to get through these levels as fast as possible, these static levels. But the enemies being spawned during it kind of change the shape of the level or the path that you're going through as you play the game. And you also see this with like Popeye, which is the arcade game he directed, Mario Brothers, and I want to argue later on for Super Mario Brothers and other things like that. But yeah, Devil World especially I think is interesting because it's like, it's Pac-Man, but just moving the screen a little bit to the right changes the shape of the level completely. Really interesting.
Right. That's all I have to say about Devil World. So okay. Let's move on to Excitebike. Excitebike is a dirt bike racing game. And the way it's set up is basically like a mechanical horse racing game where you have 4 different paths. You're playing as your little biker guy. You move up and down ramps. And you also tilt your bike around to make sure that you're landing in a correct way. You want to land basically closely to parallel to the ground, I think, based on how I play the game. And you're sort of optimizing through that sort of balancing act and also going on the correct track so that you are avoiding obstacles and going up ramps in the correct times.
Well, this is the first game where optimization is straight up just a goal, because now it's not like you lose lives if you fall over or anything. You can actually fall over as many times as you want, and your biker somehow will not be dead. But yeah, the game is based on you finishing under a specific time, and if you don't get under that time, then you just straight up lose the game. I mean, there is a level select, so it's very easy to just do that, but looking at it back from today's perspective, I'm like, it kind of like encouraged the birth of speedrunning, didn't it? All the way back from the beginning of Donkey Kong, encouraging people to finish a level as fast as possible. Yes, yes, I know the optimal strategy for beating Donkey Kong now is just to like jump over as many things as possible before getting to the end. I know that's, I'm saying for like casual players, that was how it was pitched to them, you know, finish the game as fast as possible to try and get the highest score. And Excitebike is the one where this is first made explicit. Also interesting, see all the previous games, they're all based on vertical movement. Donkey Kong, Donkey Kong Jr., it's all based on going up. Popeyes and Mario Brothers are based on like navigating vertical tiers. All of that is very vertical. This is his first horizontal type game. Ooh, there's a point to this. I'll come back to it later.
Spoilers of Super Mario Brothers. Anyway, I think the really interesting thing about Excitebike is that Miyamoto said that he had never ridden a motorbike before and had no interest in motorbikes and did zero research in producing this game. Hell so yeah. He had no interest in depicting this in a realistic fashion.
One thing Miyamoto encourages is for his developers to have like all sorts of different hobbies when designing games, because he pulls from a lot of things. And he supposedly designed the tilting of the motorbike based on how he needed to tilt his skis when he was skiing, because he was doing a lot of skiing back then. It's interesting that he managed to translate one sport to another sport, and that ended up basically being the core mechanic of the game. I would argue that the tilting is like the main thing you can control throughout the game that defines how quickly you finish. But that's interesting to me. He took one sport and applied to another sport, didn't do any research on the second sport. He released it. That became one of the best sport games on the NES. Love to see it.
Right. And the thing that's really interesting to me is that tilting is completely unrealistic for a bike to do, to basically just tilt. I mean, obviously you can have some degree of control over your bike when you're riding throughout the air, but like you can't switch back and forth where however you want. But for Miyamoto, he chose to go in a completely different way where it's completely unrealistic, where you have complete control in this area. And I want to get to this because Miyamoto finds the choosing what is realistic and what isn't to be a defining part of game creation and game authorship, because Miyamoto sees the director as the sort of creator of the game. I'm not going to say auteur, I'm not going to put that word in his house, but the creator of the game is the director, because they get to choose what parts to simulate and what parts not to simulate. I have a quote here from one of his interviews where he says, quote, "Just by changing the director in a game, a great deal will end up coming out differently. If you really do try to create some ultimate realistic thing, no matter how much time and memory space you have, it eventually won't be enough. Then you'll have to decide where to draw the line on different things. And that's where you can see a director's personality come through." End quote. And this is like a really old interview. I want to say it's 80s or 90s. And I think it's really interesting to see this sort of personality and idea of authorship come through in this early period where he's already like considering a director as the creator of a work and already like defining the line on where that is, where sort of reducing the simulation and going deviating from the simulation into something completely unrealistic is where he sees a director's work come through. And I think that's really fascinating.
To be fair, he is obviously biased. He's, you know, claiming that the director is the author of a work because he is a director. At some point in this keynote for GDC, he claims that when he was working on Donkey Kong back in those days, he claimed to be one of the best game designers in the world. But that was based on his definition of game designer, which was graphic design and narrative design. So he was the best at the definition that he came up with. So yeah, I would say he's a bit biased. But to be fair, though, he said that quote later on after he did a bunch of producing work and after he kind of retired, semi-retired from direction. So I don't think he's like exaggerating there. I think he has seen a fair share of directors going through a bunch of different projects and touching in on things. And I think that's his natural conclusion. And hey, guess what? It's my natural conclusion, too. Hey, Miyamoto, have you heard of a podcast called Secret Boss? Might want to be the third co-chair, you know?
Just invite him on, and he's going to... I think he speaks English, but I prefer he just spoke Japanese on our podcast.
Yeah, every episode we're just like, what the fuck are you talking about, man? You're so cool.
You're so cool, man. Keep going. Next up is a little game called Kung Fu, which Miyamoto ported. He did not make the original arcade game called Kung Fu, but he ported it to the Famicom. And yeah, do you know what the original Kung Fu is about?
It was like Archer McLean's Karate or something. I don't remember the name.
It was an adaptation of Spartan X in Japan, which is a English translation of the Japanese name for the movie, which was originally a Jackie Chan movie called Wheels on Meals.
Wait, hang on. There is no scene in Wheels on Meals that represents anything.
Exactly.
They're outdoors the entire movie. Kung Fu is just all indoors. What the hell are you talking about?
But it's an adaptation, apparently.
Oh my
god. Based on the research I did.
The entire movie, they're on like roller skates. That would have been a better game than whatever this is. Sucks.
So you want to give your thoughts on Kung Fu?
Yeah, I think it's a devil game made by the Satanists, you know? Because like, I mean, you had pure games like Devil World, obviously, because it was, you know, for Christ, and Excitebike, which was very Christ-like because it went from left to right. Here at Kung Fu, they do some fucked up shit. Somebody must have stabbed or held Miyamoto at gunpoint because the game goes from right to left. The games don't go from right to left. What's wrong with you? Let's move on.
Right. So, well, I want to say that Kung Fu is a side-scrolling beat-em-up. where the screen is scrolling and you're fighting a lot of different enemies back and forth. This is important to Miyamoto because he basically said that he took on the project specifically to better understand the programming behind side scrolling and scrolling video games. And that is also like part of the development of Devilworld and Excitebike, to really understand the programming behind a scrolling video game. Because Miyamoto is not a programmer. During the early games of video games, if you're making a video game, and especially in charge of making a video game, you had to know programming. But Miyamoto had a graphic design background, and it's really interesting to see, like, even 20 years later, him talking in interviews about how he doesn't know how to program, but he learns the limitations of programming to figure out what he can do within the sort of technical constraints of the game.
I think it's very interesting what you said about scrolling, because Kung Fu is the only game, I think, where you move horizontally exclusively, but also you can move backwards. Meanwhile, Super Mario Brothers, you can't go back left. Only Kung Fu is the only game where you can go from right and left, and he was like, let's just throw that away.
The only game ever.
Yep.
Anyway, all that learning about side-scrolling and how that will work eventually came to fruition in Super Mario Brothers, one of the most famous games ever made, and for a very long time was like one of the most distributed games ever, which was really amazing for me to hear about. Well, everyone knows Super Mario Brothers. You play as Mario. Bowser has kidnapped Princess Peach or Princess Toadstool, and you have to go along side-scrolling levels to save her, and you're jumping along in these abstract worlds, jumping very high up in the air, running very quickly if you want to, having a great deal of control in the air and on the ground of your movement, and it's very fun to move around and go through these side-scrolling levels. And it turns out that was a really big hit. People think Super Mario Brothers is really good. And also, the first level teaches you how to play it, which is an original idea that I just thought of right now.
That's crazy. You gotta do a whole video about that, man. Like a one hour. No one's ever done that one before. Well, okay. This is a thing about like looking back in retrospect. That it's like, for me, looking at Super Mario Brothers now, I'm like, well, this is the culmination of like everything he's done before. You can see so many different threads of what he's doing before leading here. But another part of me is like, is it really though? Or am I just looking back on it because it's the most popular game? Through Donkey Kong, there's a lot of encouragement in going exclusively up to progress the game. There's not really any incentive to go back down in Donkey Kong 1 or Donkey Kong Jr. And I would say this is the same way for Super Mario Brothers. From the very beginning, to steal from all the video essays that are talking about the very first level, you start on the left side of the screen and there's a bunch of empty space on the right side of the screen. You can't go left, so the game is telling you you have to go right to progress the game. That's basically holds true for the entire game. So it's like, again, that uniform direction moving you through things. You have a timer in the top right encouraging you to kind of hurry, even if the timer is not that big of a deal, to be honest. You play through multiple levels if you die or get game overs, which is obviously very common. So you kind of learn to optimize your way through the first couple levels. One thing I want to say is very interesting. Is this quote that I found about Super Mario Brothers. Quote, "At the planning stage, we talked about wanting to make a game that will compile the best parts of all post-Donkey Kong platformers and also set a new standard. We all thought it was going to be our final celebration of cartridge games. We had a lot of fun making it." Unquote. The final celebration of cartridge games. Like, this would be like, this is where it's gonna end, basically. Close off all the platformers, we're done. One last hurrah. As if it wasn't like the start of every other platformer that would come after it.
I think that that's because there's the development of the Famicom disc system. I don't really know the history behind that very well, and I don't know if it came out like right after or anything, but they were working on discs for the Famicom, and then after that, they were famously going to cartridges for like stuff for the Nintendo 64 instead of the PlayStation. I'm not going anywhere with that, but I think that's kind of where he was thinking.
Okay. Yeah. Or maybe he was just tired of platformers and wanted to move on. I think he wanted to move on from just like athletic games that were what they were described as you can clearly see through the next game that he made.
I think this is really a defining game for understanding Miyamoto and a lot of where his design influence and where his consulting and ideas would go in the future, because Mario Brothers is a game that is just really fun to play in simple movement. Even if you don't have a goal in mind, if you're not trying to win the level, if you just jump around in Mario, it's a lot of fun. You have a lot of control over your character. You can jump up high in the air, you can do little short jumps, and you can also run. You can have a great degree of control over your character, where you're running really fast or you're running really slow. The animation is faster if you're running faster. So you have that visuals of your movement and see what your impact is almost immediately. And also there's a great deal of inertia to Mario. So you have a certain level of challenge. It's not like a real life where like you have very strong control over your body at least if you're not clumsy like me, you're interfacing with the game, and you understand that you are not the character within the game, and there isn't really a part of you that's saying, oh yeah, that's me. It's sort of like, okay, how can I control Mario? What is he doing? How can I stop him and optimize this part of the game? And what parts can I just really go as quickly as I can? And another really cool thing about Mario is, it encourages speed running, because running is really fast in this game, and it just feels so good to do. But also, if you want to like slow down and sort of explore the area, there's a whole lot of secrets. A lot of games before this didn't really have a lot of secrets. That's a wild generalization, but I think that there were definitely games with secrets before Super Mario Brothers. Don't get me wrong, but Mario is just so jam-packed with secrets, and it feels like basically every level there's like a few different things for you to find. If you just explore, you can go down pipes, you can find hidden vines that grow out of random blocks, and there are hidden blocks, there are also warp pipes that if you like sort of sneak your way through the top of the level, you can go and warp to a different level in the game. And there are also lots of glitches. There are infinite life glitches. There's the famous Minus World, where if you glitch through the level, then there's this really fucked up level called the Minus World, where nothing seems to make sense. And I think that just having that exploratory avenue for what is a pretty simple level-based game is just incredibly simple yet effective aspect of Miyamoto's work, and would really go on to like define video games as a medium where discovering something is part of the joy of most video games today, and those that aren't are focused on mastery and doing the best you can, which Mario also does. It really feels like the first really modern game to me, and it's Super Mario Brothers. It's one of the most influential games of all time.
I'd totally agree with that. Like, I would say, I talked before a little bit about the transition from arcade to like fully understanding what consoles are made for, and how you can kind of repeat levels and kind of like obsess over the same object again and again and again without having to put in a quarter. And I think this Super Mario Brothers especially is when he really goes from being arcade Miyamoto to console Miyamoto. You can hear him talking about it during like the behind the scenes things, in that a lot of the secrets apparently were based on glitches that he found throughout the game. Like, apparently the repeating coin block, when you kept hitting the same coin block and it would keep spewing out coins, that was supposed to be a glitch. All the coin blocks were supposed to only hold one coin. But after somebody discovered it, it was Miyamoto who was like, wait, keep that in the game, we might be able to do something with that. Eventually, he added in little things that you couldn't figure out, I'm guessing, just like through gameplay alone, usually. Like, if you could keep stomping on the same Koopa, eventually you get one-ups. That's not something you can figure out just like through normal play. It's only after mastery or like playground rumors that's something you can figure out. And of course, I'm assuming Warp Zone was something he figured out after realizing you can run at the top of the screen. He really gets into like maximum secrets getting in a bunch of later games.
I think this is a good opportunity for me to talk about what I think is Miyamoto's sort of video game aesthetic. This is a new term I made up specifically for this episode. It's called surrealist continuity. Oh yeah, see, I made up a word. That means I'm really smart. If you make up jargon, you can make up a whole academic article about it and you'll get famous. It's incredible. I'm going to do that right after this episode. Anyway, surrealist continuity. What I find interesting about Mario and a lot of Miyamoto's other works is that it's not very realistic. There's a lot of very strange things that happen to Mario. If you eat a mushroom, you turn into a larger character, like I guess Alice in Wonderland, I guess. And there are a bunch of like walking turtles that if you stomp on them, then they bounce and move around. And a lot of it like makes sense on one level, but another level of like realism, it just completely abandons everything you would understand about like the real world. Like, okay, why wouldn't eating a mushroom make you grow? Why is it not giving you hallucinogens like a bunch of Newgrounds animations would tell you? But the gameplay really comes first, and then they sort of like think of what character, what figure would kind of like make that sort of make sense visually, and then they sort of expand on that without any coherence or like world building. They just sort of make the thing like what is going to work in this individual instance and what is going to feel good, and then whatever goes after that. We're just going to keep building on that aspect. The worlds are designed around gameplay instead of vice versa, and the desire to explore and play in that world is considered that game's world building instead of like lore, like big heavy textbooks that would come along with the game. So that's my take on what Miyamoto's visual style is basically throughout his entire non-realist work.
I also agree. He did talk about this in some interviews. I think he calls it at one point like a free associative game. I think he was talking with Yuji Horii, and Yuji Horii, after hearing his process, describes it as a free associative game. It's important to mention that Super Mario Bros. Comes from the mythology in quotes, mythology of Mario Brothers, which is the arcade cabinet where you kind of have to navigate up and down and kick Koopas over. That was a game which, yeah, you had multiple tiers and you hit enemies from below, basically. And you had to knock them over after they've fallen over after you hit them from the bottom. And Miyamoto was like, okay, well, I've designed this thing where you navigate multiple tiers. What's an enemy that could be hurt from underneath specifically? And he realized, oh, a turtle. You can't jump on it from the top. You have to hit it from the bottom. Then he was like, well, what kind of world would suit a turtle? Then he was like, the sewers, that would be perfect. And he was like, oh, there are pipes that come out in Kyoto that are like a little weird. I guess we'll design those too. But why is Mario underground in the sewer? Oh, he's a plumber. So basically he just invented the entire mythology of Mario to justify having turtles in the video game. Also, I love this quote. I copied it specifically where he was like, I want Mario to grow when he gets bigger. And like that way it kind of locks off some areas. So it'd be kind of interesting to like navigate between powerful and not powerful. What item am I going to use for that? He picks a mushroom and he goes, quote, how mysterious. That's his reasoning for it.
Really? I could have That's sworn it. That he like referenced Alice in Wonderland at some point, but maybe I was wrong.
It could be a reference. Yeah, but I think that the goal is just to be like an object that is so like unknown when it comes to like the properties that it gives you in the first place. Like when it comes to survival, you know, lizard brain wise, that it kind of can make you grow. Why not?
Anyway, that's all anyone ever has to say about Super Mario Brothers, one of the most important games ever made, and it could all be described within about 20 minutes.
I just want to say before we move on, fuck you, Miyamoto, from adding those castle levels where you, if you go in the wrong path, you have to keep going through the same path in a loop. Those never appear in future games, and I just want to say, yeah, no wonder they don't. It's the most influential game of all time, and nobody ever copies that part. I wonder why. Maybe it's because it's the worst thing you've ever done.
I completely forgot about that. But you know what that does carry on to? The Legend of Zelda, and in almost every single Zelda game, the Lost Woods exists where you do the same exact shit, but at least it gives you hints in Zelda. There's some kind of hint in most Zelda games about how to get to the Lost Woods, whereas in Super Mario Brothers, there very much is not.
At least there's no timer in The Legend of Zelda that kills you if you take too long, you fucking asshole.
Yeah, anyway, The Legend of Zelda, you play as, I guess, Link, but he's unnamed. I guess you could name him whatever you want, besides Zelda. No. Don't do it. Because if you name your character Zelda in The Legend of Zelda, you get a completely different structure to the game.
Oh, do you? Wow.
Yeah. That's the second quest in The Legend of Zelda, where basically everything is rearranged in the game. And it's basically a whole different structure to it. I've never done it, but apparently it's much harder.
Wow. Undertale reference.
I'm not going to build on that at all.
This episode is just not refusing to build on the bits that I'm giving you.
I'm not going to engage. I'm not going to encourage this.
Aren't I such a good co-host?
No, see, I'm keeping us on track onto the actual games. No jokes here. I'm very serious. Legend of Zelda, other important game. It was considered an RPG at the time. Now people will yell at you if you call it an RPG because it is basically an action RPG, but it's stripping down all the stat elements where instead of progressing through experience and levels, you're progressing by getting a bunch of items that will help you explore the area and sort of build your strength by collecting things and finding things in the overworld instead of like building your own character. Because as Miyamoto would say, that you yourself are gaining experience instead of your character within the game.
Also, just want to point out, I think he cites Highlight and other games as games that he played before creating
The Legend of Zelda.
Yeah, I think that the timeline might be off there, but he talks a lot in general about his design philosophy being basically avoiding trends. There's a great interview where this is like Nintendo 64 days, and he's asked why he's avoiding online gaming and like interpreting it. And he says, quote, it's a trend. And I try to avoid all trends, unquote. Total rebel. But yeah, he tried to avoid classifying Legend of Zelda specifically as an RPG because he realized it would be competing with all the other RPGs if he classified it as that. He does that also with Star Fox and avoiding trying to classify it as a shoot-em-up. So he tries to deviate specifically from other games that other genres are doing just to avoid being associated with them in the market in general because he doesn't really want to compete. And you can really see that when they develop the Wii, but that's a lot further down the line. Let's just focus on Legend of Zelda for now.
Right. Miyamoto is known for his user experience and making things really accessible to people. And experience and levels and all that sort of thing can be a pretty major barrier to a lot of your market, especially if you're marketing to children, even if they're going to play Pokemon in a decade and really get into that with all those stats. But anyway, The Legend of Zelda was very accessible because you basically didn't have to think about all that math. And the inventory system was also very understandable. You basically would press the start button and you would see little icons for each of your items, and you could navigate that instead of having a more programmer mind minded drop down menu where you're selecting from a bunch of different words. Like if you're thinking of, I don't know, Dragon Quest or something, where you see just a bunch of different words that would list out all your spells. In The Legend of Zelda, all of your different actions are just little icons, very basic things. And this would be like before that sort of design would be really prevalent in computers and PCs and stuff. So this was very influential in game design in that way. But the cool part about The Legend of Zelda is that it's basically open world. You can navigate this huge area in basically whatever order you want. And there is like some roadblocks like you might see in other Zelda games, where you have to get items to get to certain areas. But for the most part, you can pretty much go wherever. You don't really have a direction to go to. You're just told to get all the Triforce pieces and save Princess Zelda in the manual for the game. Whereas in the actual game, you're just kind of doing whatever. But you should read the manual if you're going to play The Legend of Zelda, because it will explain basically everything, all the secrets, if you're going to play this game. Otherwise, you're going to be completely lost, because The Legend of Zelda is filled with very obtuse secrets for you to find. And on the one hand, that's really cool if you come across them, or if you're in the 80s and you have other school children sort of discussing the game with you. But if you're playing this without a guide in the 21st century, that can be very frustrating to have a bunch of random secret stuff that would massively improve your experience of the game and your strength and everything. Whereas there's really very little indication to find a whole lot of this stuff unless you sort of push every rock, flame every tree, bomb every wall. This is a little bit exaggerated. You could get through this game well enough without all that stuff, but it'll be very, very difficult, I will say.
Yeah, I mean, who would try to play Legend of Zelda without using a guide? I play Legend of Zelda without using a guide. I did not find any of the secrets. Did not progress at all for any of it.
But were you looking at the manual?
No, I did not look at the manual.
Okay.
I was completely lost. Yeah. Well, no, actually, I did find the first two pieces of the Triforce, which is good. That means you can beat like the first two parts of the game, but I didn't find any of the secrets behind any of the walls or anything that people were complaining about. So I don't know. Do you have to find the secrets to beat the game to get the third Triforce piece? I just gave up after.
To beat the game, there are secrets that you will have to uncover. There are hints within the game, but you very much need the manual to really understand how to get through some parts of it, or you could bomb every wall and stuff. But yeah, if you don't have the manual, you're fucked. If you do have the manual and you don't have someone telling you where to get the blue ring, which will half the amount of damage you take, you're probably also fucked unless you're an elite gamer.
That's actually insane. There's an item that halves the damage you take?
Yes.
Oh my
yes.
God. I think this is really where the console thing starts getting into play. Like, Super Mario Brothers is already crazy in that you're going over the same levels, but also you can go through multiple paths to the end, but you always end at the flagpole. Now it's really like, okay, we're really going non-linear now. But what's interesting to me is that you still have times where you're like optimizing the path through a place. Like, there's that quest where you have to get the paper, I think, from the old man and deliver it to the old woman. So the old man and the old woman are placed like at different parts of the map, and you basically, if you keep failing like me, you have to optimize a path from the old man to the old woman, which I think is interesting, because it's like you restart from the overworld with like the same amount of health. You don't lose or start from the beginning all the way like in Super Mario Brothers. So there is some kind of like saving feature now, and now it's like you have the same experience when it comes to the hearts and stuff like that, but the real experience is you learning to navigate the world, the open space, which is what I think comes from Donkey Kong and Super Mario Brothers and stuff like that. God, there was another thing I wanted to mention, but I forgot. Oh yeah, the idea of having secrets in the game anyways. It's not something you would have in an arcade game, obviously, because you're in and out very quickly. But now that it's a console game, now that you have secrets, you have time to like discuss it with your friends in the playground or whatever, and keep coming back to it, or like get back to it, you know, over a course of days or over a course of weeks or whatever, which I think is very nice. Yeah. You can really see him coming into his own.
Yeah. And then the next game he worked on said, what if the secrets fucked you over?
I love this. This is basically him seeing all the popularity he's gotten. And he's like, you know what? I want to burn it all down. Let's go.
Yeah, next up came Super Mario Brothers 2. Not the one in America, but the one in Japan, which is infamously very difficult and very frustrating. It's basically the exact same setup as Super Mario Brothers. Same visual style, same physics, same everything. Except the world is designed in a very difficult fashion. It's basically assuming that you play the first game. And there are also a bunch of secrets that will murder you. Most famously is the poison mushroom. Whereas the super mushroom, if you got it, it would greatly increase your power. If you get the poison mushroom, though, you die. You lose if you get the poison mushroom.
And that's the first power up you find in the game in the first level. It's so ridiculous. Also, if you fought the non-linear parts in Super Mario Brothers was crazy, get this, it's even more non-linear now. Now you can find a warp zone that sends you back to the beginning of the game. Yay!
I forgot about that.
It's so evil. You'd think he was going through like some devastating emotional trouble in real life to be like, I want to punish you. I want to grab you by the throat and shake you.
Yeah, I think in retrospect, a lot of people, and like even at the time, a lot of people were thinking about Super Mario Brothers 2 as like, what were they thinking? Why did they do this? But I think that looking at it through an auteur's lens makes it make a lot more sense because Miyamoto is less focused on the goal part of a game, less focused on actually getting to the end, and is more interested in the play and having challenges that even if you lose, you're having fun getting through it. At least from his perspective, from a lot of other people's perspective, notably mine, it's very frustrating and terrible, and I hate it. But it's also fun in a way, I guess, if you're a kind of masochist.
I can see a way that it's interesting. Miyamoto keeps talking for all his interviews about like how he's aware video games cost a lot of money, so he really wants to make the games worth it for the player. I think I can see this kind of game being a game that a lot of people buy, being very excited for the sequel to Super Mario Brothers, and kids being around the playground going, what the fuck is this game? And it's like the game becomes a kind of enemy in this sense, and you kind of like have to team up with your fellow classmates to like figure out ways to get around it and beat it, basically. It's basically taking the fun parts about conversating around Super Mario Brothers and Legend of Zelda and turning it like against the players, where now everyone is part of a team fighting this. Of course, I didn't get any of this experience because I played it alone by myself in my apartment crying, so I'll never get that experience, but it'll be very interesting. It would be very interesting to see what a group could do against Super Mario Brothers 2.
You know, Super Mario Brothers 2 is really the Dark Souls of video games, if you think about it.
It's really the Remember 11 of platformers.
Nobody's going to understand that reference.
You're going to get that reference in like 80 episodes when we finally cover that person.
Yep, that's definitely going to happen.
It's a setup.
Anyway,
it's a setup.
And this part is a setup to Super Mario Bros. 3, which is the greatest game ever made, if you ask me, when I was like 10 years old, because it was one of the very first great games I played. It was like, oh shit, Super Mario Bros. 3, it's so good. And by that, I mean I played the Game Boy remake, but still, really, really good. I love Super Mario Bros. 3. What are your thoughts?
This one's really innovative because it came up with a unique premise for the Super Mario Bros. Series, which is, what if a Super Mario Bros. Game was fun? This is, that was uncalled for, I'm sorry.
Disagree.
I like the first one, okay? It's not even that much of a, I don't know, 3 is fine. I'm going to be real with you. I don't really like that much of any of the Super Mario Bros. Games, 1 through 3. It's not my thing, but I think Super Mario Bros. 3 is very interesting in how, like, how much everything it is. So many new mechanics, so many different worlds. It's really just like a jacked up version. I really am still surprised it came out on the same system as the NES. You can see little things that cross over from Super Mario Bros. 1, obviously just like the basic platforming. But like one thing I think we neglected to mention with Super Mario Bros. 1 is they have cutscenes in the game where whenever you go underground or go underwater, there's always a cutscene when you start the level of Mario going into a pipe from above ground to below ground. So there's like an emphasis on having to transition from a level from above ground to below ground. There's not like you immediately start the level in the water or underground, although Miyamoto could have easily done that. And here with Super Mario Bros. 3, that transition comes over even bigger because it's like now you have an overworld with like, if you start on world 2, there's a big desert overworld. And when you click into the level, then you're in a desert level. So there's like more transition from the background to the foreground. He's starting to develop that.
Yeah, and it expands on the original game with the P meter, whereas in the very first Super Mario Brothers game, running was not very encouraged. It was fun to run, but a careful player would kind of avoid that. In Super Mario Bros. 3, you're highly encouraged to run as much as possible because it increases your P meter, and that P meter will allow you to fly if you have certain power-ups. And it's just really, really fun to move around in Super Mario Bros. 3, in my opinion. There are also like a lot of other power-ups. There's the classic Fire Flower. There's also a frog suit, which slows you down to a crawl if you're on land. It makes you jump in a very awkward way, but allows you to swim better. And I feel like I'm just going to gush about all the parts of Super Mario Bros. 3 I like because it was one of the first games I fell in love in. But design-wise, it really is just an expansion of the Super Mario Bros. And sort of doing basically everything that you would want Mario to do in a basic 2D platformer. And the world map allows for a lot of similar mechanics throughout each world. There's one world, which is mostly water, where you do a lot of water mechanics. Then one after that is a giant level where you're facing a bunch of really big enemies. And then the fifth one lets you go into the sky, which originally happens on the world map, which is really cool. Like, the world map is changing based on how you're playing throughout the level. And then you can just go into the sky after that. The world map just completely shifts and changes. Like, you're seeing the change in the game through the interface that you might just abstract into, like, oh, hey, this is kind of nothing. But even in that abstraction, you're sort of interacting with the game, which is really cool. And then you go into up into the air and have some challenging platforming in the air levels. Anyway, Mario 3, masterpiece. I love it. One of my favorite games ever. Don't have a lot of deep thoughts other than it really expands the idea of secrets in the game. There are so many secrets in Mario 3. And yeah, it's just, it's a visual masterpiece. I love it so much.
And I don't have anything to say about it. Period.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding.
Gotta be 10 years old to play this game.
Legitimately, the only thing I have to add about it is, oh, the devil world, the crushing thing is back when it comes to scrolling with the airship levels. Now the level automatically scrolls and you have to navigate. Otherwise, you get crushed. I think that's interesting. That's all. Shit game. Let's move on.
Terrible. You're hurting me. All right. What do you want to cover next?
I mean, okay, I just want to say this is very interesting to me. Star Fox is a game that he was credited as directing. The only game he directed on the SNES. He didn't design or direct any other game on the SNES other than Star Fox.
Yeah, I found that interesting that you had that. I couldn't find what source was you using for that credit, because I didn't see it on Wikipedia. I don't think I even saw it on my book or Moby Games.
Sorry. Not, yeah, you're right. Not director. Designer. Just designer.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah, but yeah, this is sort of the period where he would sort of consult on a lot of games and not really direct on anything in specific. Whereas in a lot of Japanese video game culture, if you, or company culture in general, I think, if you're good at your position, you move up a level, you're going to move up the ranks and sort of have more people under you to work under you because you are doing so well. So if you're doing really well in your game design, you're going to be a director. Doing really well in your director, you're going to be a producer. Really good at producer, you're going to be an executive. And this is when he begins to be more of a producer. And then later in the 2000s, he would be more of a executive where he's just doing everything within the company. Whereas now he's just overseeing a lot of projects and consulting on them and saying, hey, I'm developing new talent, some new directors, but I'm also going to be guiding you like Gunpei Yokoi guided me. Yokoi's still there, whatever. they're both doing that at this time. So he's involved with a lot of different projects and inspires a lot of projects, but he doesn't direct for a very long time. He doesn't do any big directing projects until Super Mario 64, 1996.
Yep, here we go. As they say in Super Mario 64, here we go.
Did you do that on purpose? You really, no, you really like jump scared
I really
me.
Came up with it, like, randomly. I came up with that on the spot, honestly. Yeah, no, this is where I have all my chits, honestly. This is, like, everything to me. This was, to be honest, my first time playing any N64 game at all, like anything. And I was doing it for the podcast, playing Super Mario 64. And I have to say, controversial opinion. I know a lot of people have a lot of opinions on it. Yeah, I think it's very good. Sorry to all the haters, but I think it's a good game. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you know, Super Mario 64, famously hated game.
Yep. Remember when I said Super Mario Brothers was the culmination of everything he was doing before? Well, actually, that was a lie, because Super Mario 64 is the culmination of everything he did before that into one game.
To be clear, we are joking. Super Mario 64 is like one of the most acclaimed 3D games. It was one of the first major 3D platformers that really understood where it was going to go in the future. I think like Crash Bandicoot came out first, and that was very much translating 2D gameplay into a 3D space. And there are a lot of other games like that, but Super Mario 64 came out with the analog stick instead of the D-pad, which a lot of games were doing before then, where you had like 360-degree control and you were able to move in very slight directions. The games are focused more on exploring rather than individual avoiding enemies platforming challenges. So your goal is instead to explore the level. There are some difficult jumps and difficult platforming sections, but it's a lot more open-ended and a lot more focused on your finding places within the world and finding your objectives, which are stars. And you're not necessarily knowing where you're going to go. Super Mario Bros., you're always going to the right. But in Super Mario 64, you're just kind of exploring the level and seeing what you can do here. There are mini games and there are characters to talk to. And it just really changes the landscape for the 3D platformer into a more intuitive and exploratory area. Well, it's more quote unquote immersive.
Lots of interesting things here. Speed is encouraged, like in the earlier arcade games. It isn't a timer or anything, but there are like games where you race after a bunch of NPCs through the level. This entire game is basically about optimizing your path through a level. You can argue like Super Mario Brothers kind of has that, but Super Mario 64, when you keep coming back to the same area, trying to get different stars within the same area, it's all about finding different paths you can go through the same level and how the context of the goal changes your path through the goal. So it's really always your skill in the game is basically, I mean, besides getting better at the movement in the game, also just like getting better at navigating throughout the same level and figuring out shortcuts and things like that, which I think is interesting. Yeah. Because Super Mario Brothers is not really about place. It's more just about moving right. And now Mario 64 is all about the place. There's nowhere you can go. Also, remember how Donkey Kong starts off with you going up, all the way up? Donkey Kong Jr. starts with you going all the way up. Then he moves to the NES and he starts going horizontal, maybe because the screen is horizontal. Kung Fu goes horizontal. Super Mario Brothers goes horizontal. All that stuff. You finally get to Super Mario 64, which is three dimensions. Guess what the first level is? Oh, you gotta go up a mountain. Second level, you go up a mountain. Third level, you go down a snowy mountain. And you also go down a slide. Fourth level, you go down into the ocean. Every level in Super Mario 64 is about going up or down. We're going back to the vertical navigation thing in the arcade era, but with new mechanics and mixed with things that he learned from the NES area. I also think it's very interesting that the first level, Bomb on Battlefield, has you go up a hill while objects are rolling down after you and you have to dodge them as you reach the top. You know, like the video game Donkey Kong.
I wonder if they had Donkey Kong in mind during that first level, like if they're going to use the character there or if they were just like inspired by it. Because that is really funny to think about. It very much feels like the first Donkey Kong level just translated into 3D. Yeah. I didn't really think about that before.
I don't think they had introduced Donkey Kong in any of the Super Mario Brothers games up to that point, right? Or like any of the Mario Brothers games.
Yeah. They abandoned Donkey Kong. He was gone.
Man, that's messed up. Well, I totally forgot about the Donkey Kong Country series. Yeah.
Yeah, it's weird to think that like, oh yeah, Mario is a spinoff of Donkey Kong. Donkey Kong's the OG.
Yeah.
But yeah, Mario 64, lots of exploring, lots of jumping around. It actually feels good to run around. I'm not sure how true this is, but there's a famous tale where Miyamoto was focused on making the movement fun to move around in before he did anything else within the game, and then built the game around the controls afterward, which I think is a fun fact, and it's sort of how I think about games going forward, even. I don't know how true that is, but it's how I think about games. Like, okay, it's gotta be fun to play even if there aren't any objectives. And this is like the apex of that in the 3D space. It's like, okay, people don't like 3D games very much. They're very confusing. Let's just make this fun to play and then we'll do everything else. And Mario 64 is fun to play and jump around in. I love that. So good.
I think that is true, based on what I heard. From the story they developed, it was even before they developed the N64 that it was about movement. They created this 3D environment where Mario could jump around, just like a tiny little sandbox room, and they were like, we just want this sandbox room to be able to work on the N64 before we move ahead. Obviously, because you have to know your creative technical limitations. But once they figured that out, it's like, okay, yeah. We'll just have the movement, and then everything else is built from that. Did you know that the levels in Super Mario 64 were improvised? Miyamoto started with a general shape of the level, and then he added details throughout as they walked around it, basically. Why would they do that?
I wonder if part of that is that Miyamoto on the Famicom and Super Famicom and everything, he was creating games through graph paper, because these systems were pixel-based, so he would just graph out all these different levels and like told the programmers, hey, put this in the game, and then they did. So he was very visual at first, but I guess that wouldn't translate very well to the 3D area, so I guess he had to improvise there. And interestingly, Miyamoto would not direct another game for a very long time, and not direct another 3D game, really, after Super Mario 64. It just kind of stopped there.
Another thing that's very interesting to me is that the Playground stuff carries over. I feel like Playground talk is very interesting when it comes to Miyamoto's games, because it does kind of spread itself through the Super Mario Bros. Games and the Legend of Zelda games. There are very strange rituals in Super Mario 64 that you have to do to, like, accompany things. Like, I didn't know this until I looked it up. When you have these wooden stumps in Bomb on Battlefield, you can run around them 5 times and coins will sprout out. Makes no sense at all, but it's something that you can figure out by yourself and then talk to your friends about. And also how you get the red wing cap, which I beat the entire game without getting. And I only looked it up later just to figure out how you can find it. And when I found the answer, I was like, oh, that's complete bullshit. How would I ever have figured that out? Just wanted to mention that because I'm mad about it. Also, just crazy is that there's one level where it's like, how are you going to get to that cage all the way up there? You have to jump all the way up there to get. And the answer is there's just an owl and a random tree that will just take you up there like automatically. Why would you do that? Whatever, whatever.
But if you're good, you can jump over there. I can't do it, but other people can.
Yeah, but it's so much easier. I didn't even, like, I genuinely did not know the owl was a part of the game. No one talked about it until I found it. And I was like, how would I? This was like after several attempts to try and get up to the cage. I was like, how would I have possibly figured that out on my own? But yeah, that's the playground thing coming back again. I don't know. We should have brought it up before. But yeah, Minamoto talks about this thing about a box garden. This is where his immersive theory comes in. He doesn't want to create like extremely realistic environments. I think he was interviewed one time and he was like, yeah, we're never going to do like photorealistic graphics like other companies might, as it turns out with like Call of Duty or like all the NVIDIA, you know, GeForce 10,000 or whatever. He's not focused on photorealistic graphics, but he also wants to make the player feel like they're the character in game. As a matter of fact, Super Mario Brothers was developed with Mario having the cap on, because if he had the cap off, then it would animate the hair as he ran, and they didn't want to do that, so they just kept his hat on, basically. So there are little things that like break the immersion of the game if it's not there, like the wheels on the car not spinning if you're driving. Simultaneously, he also wants to make places that you can feel like you can live in, which is kind of what he did with Legend of Zelda Ocarina of Time when he was producing it, but especially what he does with Super Mario 64. I love the little details here, like the little butterflies flying around when you're in the grassland, and how you like explore every inch of this map. It feels really lived in. And I think that's a much smarter decision to move to, other than, oh, you just have to get to the end of this level, or you just have to get to the end of that level. I don't know. I was really floored by Super Mario 64.
Turns out Super Mario 64 is a good game. Yeah.
Fuck that red wing cap part, though. Okay, let's move on.
Well, after Super Mario 64, he doesn't direct for a very long time. He consults on a lot of different projects. And most importantly, he plays a pivotal role on the Wii, where he is helping the design of that system and making it interesting, where you're doing motion control, which hadn't really been developed very well since then. And then, yeah, he did a lot of work on the Wii. And then he would finally direct his most recent game, Super Mario Run, 20 years after Super Mario 64. Super Mario Run, in case you're not familiar, is a mainline Mario game, but it's for your phone. And it's basically an auto runner where you jump around by tapping on the screen. You can basically jump and you can wall jump. And that's basically it. That's all Super Mario Run is. You go through a lot of levels. This is the peak new Super Mario Brothers visual style, so it feels very generic. And I honestly, I can't say very much about this game. It feels like I'm back in the arcade era where there's not a lot to interact with and there's not a lot to do. And I guess the best thing you can do is get a high score, I guess, which feels like kind of out of date in the 2010s.
The king is back.
Yeah.
He did it. Never doubt the Miyamoto. He did it. Yeah, I didn't play this game because it was literally removed from the App Store for being so unpopular. You can't download it anymore. That's interesting that it has a high score kind of thing. Yeah, it is interesting to see him try and bring things back from the arcade to the phone. I mean, I think that kind of makes sense in that your phone is something you pick up and play. It's not something like you walk away from it eventually, you know? It's not something that you keep obsessing over like the console. But yeah. Yeah, no, I don't want to play that. That sounds bad. The only thing I have to say about it is he says at one point in an interview 25 years ago, like earlier in like the 90s or something like that, he's like, oh yeah, the IQ is a very interesting thing. That was like a tablet kind of thing. He was like, maybe if it was bigger, it would be interesting to develop games that would like work on the touchscreen. So you could say he kind of had this idea in the works for 25 years. It's just that, you know, when it came out, it was bad.
Yeah, this was very much a flop for Nintendo. It sold pretty well. It was fairly popular, but because it wasn't like mind-blowing and it was like their big foray into the mobile space, it was very disappointing to play Super Mario Run. It seemed like, oh, okay, decent auto runner that we could probably find 10 better indie developed ones. Like, why is this here? It's very, very like, kind of sad note for Miyamoto to end on as a director. Like, obviously he was doing a bunch of other stuff, especially developing the Switch and being executive there, which is very successful. But as a director, very sad to end on Super Mario Run, which is probably one of the worst Mario games.
This is the funniest part about Auteur Fairy. This is where it completely falls apart. Where you say, oh, it's sad that he ended as a director here, as if he cares. As if he cares, because he's still producing games. He's probably still having fun. He's probably still, like, having Scrooge McDuck levels of money. He probably doesn't care what last game he ended on as a director. You know, to him, it was just probably this kind of thing that he pushed out and he was like, let's try this. And it didn't work. And he was like, oh, well. Yeah. But like, yeah, I would say he prizes stuff like Even Pikmin, a game that he did not work on, he came up with the original concept for, he prizes that as his baby. So, like, what he prizes as a baby and what we prize as, like, his directorial work is very different. Just want to mention, though, the superior title for an auteur, game auteur, is designer. And he did design a game, Steel Diver 2011, for the Nintendo 3DS, the submarine game. You may be thinking, oh, that's the game where you go up and down on the submarine, right? No. That's Steel Diver. He didn't design that part. He designed a side mode for that game called Steel Commander Mode, which is completely different. What Steel Commander Mode, you ask? It's Battleship, the board game. No arterial links to that one. He strikes again. The king is back, baby. Is this totally not just some role they gave to him to, like, appease his designer want that he probably wanted to do? Definitely not. I have nothing to say about this game. It's bad. Don't play it.
I didn't look at all into what his role in Steel Diver was, but that's very funny. Anyway, Miyamoto, that's all I have to say. One of the most famous game designers out there, and we completely bodied him. We said all that needed to be said, and no one else has to talk about Miyamoto ever.
What a sad, pitiful career. What a fall from grace. He used to make Super Mario 64. Now he makes Super Mario Run. He's probably starving on the streets. Oh my god, he's so miserable. He's so fucked up.
You make one bad game at the end of your career, and then you can never live it down.
You're fucked, basically.
All right. Recommendations. I didn't really think about this beforehand. Do you have any recommendations?
I personally recommend, honestly, the first Donkey Kong has held up very well. Popeye is interesting in that I feel like it's a better version of Mario Brothers. Mario Brothers has you kind of like navigating different tiers. Popeye kind of does that as well, the arcade game. Yeah, don't play any of the sports games. That's my anti-recommendation of the week. Devil World is a very interesting version of Pac-Man. I would say it's better than Pac-Man, which is, you know, pretty cool. The Legend of Zelda, if you like exploring things, I guess you should read the manual. I didn't finish it. Super Mario Brothers, if you like that kind of thing, I don't. I guess the biggest recommendation for me is Super Mario 64, because it just completely floored me. I love the movement. I love the secrets. I love jumping up and down. I love figuring out shortcuts and everything. It's one of my favorite games that I have several rants about and yelled at several times because I kept falling off after getting the star and not collecting the star and falling to my death and having to restart the entire thing. And I recommend you look on Amazon for all the iPhones that have still undeleted copies of Super Mario Run and buy them so you can play it and be like, oh, this is not a very good game. That's my recommendation of the day. Oh, just want to recommend, not related to his altruism at all, but the GDC keynote he did a speech at, his only speech, if I remember correctly. Just go and watch the YouTube video. It's amazing. There's like an English representative at Nintendo who comes up and introduces Miyamoto. He's like trying to get the gamers super amped up, but it's clear he hasn't played any of Miyamoto's games. So he's like, The Legend of Zelda taught us to use our brains and navigate in the world. Super Mario Bros. Taught us determination. And Donkey Kong taught us how to laugh and just keeps talking, basically. And then they show an 8-minute video. I'm not kidding, 8 minutes straight of everything Miyamoto did, including all the games that he didn't actually work on. He was just like a producer on. And every time a new game shows up, you could hear everyone in the audience cheering like it's Avengers Endgame. Just like basic footage of Super Mario Brothers. And everyone's like, yeah, I recognize that game. And then Zelda comes up and they're like, yeah, Zelda.
Do they cheer at like fucking Duck Hunt? I mean, maybe not Duck, Wild Gunman. Do they cheer at Wild Gunman or baseball?
No.
Oh, sad.
They didn't show Wild Gunman or baseball. They did show Super Mario Kart, though, which he did not design. Anyways, the talk's pretty cool. I guess. I don't know. Whatever.
All right. I'm going to recommend the good Mario games, Super Mario Brothers, Super Mario Brothers 3, and Super Mario 64, because I like Mario, and I don't think I need to go too much into it. They're just good fun. I'm going to recommend The Legend of Zelda with the manual. If you're doing it without the manual, then you're fucked. Don't do that. And also, look up where to find the blue ring and the special swords if you're stuck in the callback areas. I'm going to recommend Devil World if you want to play a good Pac-Man game that's going to take you like 5 minutes to beat. I'm going to recommend that. It's kind of fun. I like it. I like Devil World. And then I think that's about it. That's good for me.
Just curious, did you ever beat Mario 2?
Oh, I didn't beat Mario 2. I'm not beating fucking Mario 2.
Okay.
I'm not doing that shit.
So what you're saying is you don't really know whether or not you should recommend it or not. You don't have the full, you know, equipped knowledge. You can't say it.
I'm pretty confident. I often speak confidently about things I don't know.
Okay.
Well, I suggested Miyamoto, and because we switch off who we're going to talk about every week or every episode, we're not doing this every week, fuck that, it's now Galvin's turn to recommend an auteur to me. So who are we covering next, Galvin?
You know, I hear your cries, the masses, the populi. I know we haven't gotten many letters, if at all, from you guys yet, which you can email us, by the way, at secretbosspodcast@gmail.com. We haven't gotten any letters yet, but I can hear your cries through your headphones. You know, where are the interactive fiction games, all right? Who have we covered? Jay Tolan, Christine Love. These are all Twitch-based, you know, extremely reflex-based, hardcore gaming-related auteurs. Where is the interactive fiction? Don't worry. I have you covered. Yeah, I wanted to get into this kind of field of interactive fiction because it's not really something I'm familiar with, but I've dabbled a little bit into it and it's very interesting to me. Specifically, I have not gotten into text parser interactive fiction. I played a few text parser games. Text parsers are games where basically you can type in anything and the game kind of responds to you, whether or not that option works or whether or not it doesn't. Of course, you still have limited options, but it's generally more free than kind of a point-click adventure kind of type of game. And I wanted to ease you in easily with this, but then I thought about it earlier today and I was like, why do that? You know? Why give you like a good introductory one? Let me just drop you into the deep end. Honestly, I don't think this guy's very complicated, but it is very interesting because I don't see many people talking about him when it comes to canonical text parser auteurs, which there are a lot of, surprisingly. Victor Heisbers. He is a university lecturer in metaphysics and philosophy of science at the Leiden University in Netherlands. That's his current career. He currently does that. He is, I think, yeah, probably a graduate student in philosophy of science. He does a lot of talking. He's very interested in Immanuel Kant and David Hume. And also, he has a philosophy YouTube channel with 12,000 subscribers, which is honestly kind of small, but it is. He has a very devoted fan base. You see a lot of people in the same comments and stuff like that. But what's interesting is not all that. It's that he's written several, I think, 24 interactive fiction short stories, and to this day is one of the most prominent and active members of the interactive fiction database community. He runs like a poll that keeps appearing year after year where people vote for the best interactive fiction games of all time. He's frequent on the forums and stuff like that. He doesn't really connect it to his day job, which is mainly acting as a lecturer of philosophy of science. So we're going to play his interactive fiction text parser games. And I think it's very interesting because there are a lot of them that are very interested in philosophy. There are a lot of them that are historical dramas, supposedly. There's one that's just straight up a philosophical experiment called The Baron. I would say that's his most popular one. That's how I heard of him. And a bunch of things that I haven't really heard of that we're going to get into. So my plan is I'm just going to look over his YouTube channel and also play his games and try to see how they connect and how his interests with philosophy connect to his interests in video games. I don't know what you're going to do. You do whatever the hell you want.
Sounds good. Yeah, I really haven't been really interested. I haven't looked into the interactive fiction crowd, especially the indie crowd, and I haven't done a lot of text parser games either. It's like a whole genre I've basically untouched besides Zork and through Black Ops. Call of Duty Black Ops had Zork, and that's how I played it.
This would be kind of a nice introduction, I think, because it's not really based on, from what I can tell, his games aren't really based on solving puzzles or things like that. Although there is a very interesting one, which is a text parser roguelike, which I had never seen before, and I don't think it's ever really been done since. I think that one won a lot of awards specifically, but that's the only one, and every other one is like based on just the story alone.
Yeah, look forward to that.
As always, I'm Galvin.
And I'm Author Function.
Thanks for listening.